Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Today, Fresh Air meets Virginia Conversations as we welcome Terry Gross to the program. I'm May Lily Lee. Thanks for joining us. Terry Gross has been hosting Fresh Air since 1975. She's heard on more than 500 radio stations, reaching a daily audience of nearly 4.5 million people. Over the years, Fresh Air and Terry have received numerous awards, including the Peabody, which noted the host's reputation for probing and unexpected questions and unusual insights. Terry is also the author of All I Did Was Ask, Conversations with Writers, Actors, Musicians, and Artists. And next month, she's appearing at the Paramount Theater in Charlottesville. Terry Gross, welcome to Virginia Conversations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here or there.
Yes, we are there.
I'm in Philadelphia as we speak.
This is the way you like to do it, right? Separate from the guest in a different location.
It's the way it is, whether I like it or not, because our studios are in Philadelphia, and we don't have the money to bring guests to Philadelphia, and they don't have the time to get there. So the only way I could talk to the guests I do is if I hook up the way you and I are hooking up now, which is long distance via ISDN line or satellite, whatever is available.
Let's say that you had every resource available and you could afford to bring in every single one of your guests. Would you still prefer this method of interviewing?
You know, they each have their advantages. The nice thing about being in the room with someone is that you have the benefit of body language. You see each other. Sometimes there is a special rapport that you get by being in the same room, but not always. Because on the flip side of that, sometimes there's a privacy and a sense of space that you get when you're not in the same room. And there is an odd sense of intimacy that you can develop when somebody's just in your headphones. And you're not in each other's physical space, but you're very much in each other's psychospace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, psychological space because of them going directly into your headphones, and it's pure radio. You know, if I want to let my guest know something, it has to be through my voice. So anything they're finding out, listeners are finding out too, because there's no special nudges and winks and smiles and nods that are going on just between me and my guest.
As you've said, anything a guest wants to communicate has to be by sound.
Exactly.
You know, The scenario that's set up around this is when Orville Schell said, it's like sitting in Freud's office. So you're on Freud's couch, and he deliberately places himself behind the subject so that the subject is left with no additional visual stimuli and no body language, as you mentioned, from the therapist. In a way, your interviews can go that way.
Well, that's an interesting analogy, and I'll make another one not to compare myself to this and not to elevate my interviews to this level. But it's, I think, no coincidence that confession booths, which I've never been in because I'm not Catholic, but confession booths, there's, I'm told, a divider that separates you from the priest that you're confessing to. And I think in some ways it's easier to say certain things when you're not looking at somebody eye to eye. Not always, but sometimes. And that's why I'm saying there's like pluses and minuses. It depends on the person.
I want to read that Orville Schell wrote of you. Ms. Gross's ability to draw her subjects out seems to increase in direct proportion to her separation.
Well, that's a nice thought. But, you know, the truth is, it doesn't make a difference to me whether somebody's in the next city or like three countries away, as long as the sound quality is good.
Now, you often ask unexpected questions about your guests' early careers. I'm going to turn the table. It's the early 70s. You were, by your own account, a hippie with frizzy hair and purple corduroys. And if it weren't for an unfortunate turn of events, you might still be edifying people as a teacher rather than as a public radio host.
I wasn't edifying anybody when I taught, unfortunately. Well, I went to college from 1968 to 72, and it was a period when a lot of what was happening on campus was very exciting, but it was outside the classroom. There was the anti-war movement and the women's movement, and on the campus I went to, the State University of New York at Buffalo, there was a thriving cultural scene. There were always movies being shown and experimental video. There was music of every sort. There were rock concerts and classical concerts and avant-garde classical concerts. And it was just poetry readings. It was an incredibly lively campus, but I spent very little time in the classroom. And then I had to figure it out, and I was an English major, so I had to figure out, and what am I going to do? And like a lot of English majors, I figured, well, I'll teach. And then I got placed. There was a lot of teachers then, more than they could use, which is probably different than now. But I was placed in my first class the day after Election Day, which meant that the students were already mobilized, and I was the newcomer. And this happened to be Buffalo, New York's toughest inner-city junior high. And I was just really ill-equipped to give the students what they needed.
There was a rumor, and apparently this was a rumor on behalf of supervisors, that you were using heroin and that somehow this rumor really sent ripples through the school.
Here's what happened. I had no idea what I was doing. I was shorter than most of my students.
Are you about 5 foot tall? 5 feet tall?
Just about.
Okay.
I'm getting there.
I think you said once it's hard for many people to be shorter than I am.
Yes, right. Right. Mm-hmm. Unless there's some kind of physiological issue that they have, you know. So the students are taller than me. I was not used to being the authority figure. I didn't know how to be the authority figure. I didn't even have like younger brothers and sisters. So I didn't even hardly think of myself as an adult. So I could barely keep the students in the classroom, let alone teach them anything. And they thought I was just weird. So this rumor started by the students, who told their parents, who told the vice principal, that I was a junkie and that I shot up in the bathroom. And they knew that from my track marks. And I thought that was really hysterical, A, because I have never I've never come close to doing anything with heroin, B, that I have no track marks, and C, you wouldn't know because I was wearing long sleeves all the time because I get cold really easily, and D, what made it especially hysterical was that this was such a kind of poor and dangerous neighborhood. The students wore their coats all the time because if they hung up the coats in there weren't lockers, you know, so if they hung up the coats in the classroom, they were afraid that they'd be stolen. Anyways, the whole thing was like kind of like an absurdist drama. And what added to the absurdity was that the vice principal took me down and in a conversation that he thought would be reassuring, said to me, "Don't worry, Miss Gross. I was once accused of raping a student in the boiler room, but believe me, the boiler room wouldn't have been large enough for that, so I understand what you're going through." And I thought, that's just the kind of backup I need.
Such a credible supporter. Fast forwarding to the failed junior high school career, you were working with WBFO Radio. Is that a volunteer capacity in which you were working with them?
Yeah, when I got fired from teaching after 6 full weeks, when I got fired, I figured, okay, so I've failed at my first profession. And even though I didn't feel called to teach, I still thought I'd be competent at it. And apparently I wasn't. So I had to figure out, well, now what? So I took all these temporary typing positions and then ended up volunteering and how I got to volunteer is like a whole other story, but I ended up volunteering at the NPR station on the college campus, WBFO.
In Buffalo. And is it true that your first radio show ever was about underwear?
I think that is the first show that I did.
Women's garments on women's power.
Let me explain, because that sounds, you know, kind of odd. But it's not quite as odd as it sounds. The show was called Woman Power, very 70s title. The show was called Woman Power, and it was basically an early feminist program. This was like 1973 or 74. And I wanted to do a show on the history of women's undergarments, like who invented the bra and the girdle, especially, you know, whale bones that that used to be used in corsets to, like, really tighten you up so you had the proper figure. Like, where did all of that come from? And I was so naive and so inexperienced in radio, because I was a volunteer who had basically just walked in. I did what I knew how to do, which is I basically went to the library, took out a bunch of books, wrote a term paper, and read it on the air. I have to say that it's like the worst imaginable kind of radio to do. I don't recommend that as a producer, as a host, or as a listener. Very bad. But, you know, I was so naive, it didn't occur to me. No, what you do is interview people who know all this stuff. You don't write a term paper.
This is a good point. In fact, editing is key. It's a craft of omission. I understand that when you interview most of your guests, you give them that opportunity. You say, look, we're recording this, so I'm happy to restart if you're not comfortable with something. And you let me know if certain questions are uncomfortable for you. That's most. That's not political figures, but that's most of your guests.
Yeah, here's what I do. I tell them that if I ask them anything too personal, that crosses the line for them, that they're going to be uncomfortable talking about, that I respect their right to privacy. So, you know, if I cross that line, they should let me know and I'll move on to something else. And I do that because when somebody is a private, you know, isn't a public figure, when they're not legislating our lives, then they should have a right to decide what's public and what's private. And the difference between them and people who are legislating our public lives is that there's a level of hypocrisy that I don't think people should stand for. If somebody is voting against our right to do something and then they're actually doing it in their private lives, I think journalists have a right to ask and a right to know. I think the public has a right to know. That's legislative hypocrisy. But in private life, you have a right to your private life, and I don't want to transgress. And I think when people know that I'm going to respect their right to privacy, they're more comfortable speaking openly and honestly.
Two public figures who felt that their interviews with you went in different directions than they wanted to were Lynn Cheney and Nancy Reagan. Both wanted to promote their books. You wanted to ask the questions that were on the minds of people at the time. Nancy Reagan, you wanted to ask about homelessness and AIDS. Lynn Cheney, ask about her gay daughter. These didn't go as well as they would have liked.
No. You know, with Lynn Cheney, this was shortly after the Cheneys and the Bushes left the White House. And so, you know, the Christian right was groups in the Christian right were big supporters of the Bush-Cheney tickets, and yet the Cheneys had an openly gay daughter, and the Christian right that was supporting them had such an anti-gay agenda, including a federal amendment to ban gay marriage. And I wanted to understand, like, how like, connect the dots for me. If you have an openly gay daughter who you love and you're proud of, and the people supporting you, who you're taking support from, oppose all things gay, oppose your daughter's right to marry, and she's since married, like, what, you know, and she just wouldn't give me anything except that she opposed a federal amendment to ban gay marriage. And I asked her to explain why, and all she would tell me was because she thinks marriage is a state's issue, not a federal issue. So this was you know, years ago. But I kept pressing her on it because I thought this is an example where somebody was supported by an anti-gay agenda. They have a gay daughter. There are so many gay people in this country. Everyone, you know, gay people and straight people have a right to know how this can be. Do you know what I mean? And also just a right of curiosity. Like, if you have a gay daughter, why wouldn't you stand up and support her in the way that so many parents of gay children do? So I asked her about the group PFLAG, which is Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, which was one of the early, like, parent support groups of gay people. Like, you know, what did you think of groups like that? So anyways, that's how the interview went.
Very few people have ever walked out on your interviews. Bill O'Reilly famously walked out back in 2003. Mm-hmm. What was going on there?
What was going on there? I had him on because I had just interviewed Al Franken about his book Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, which was a satirical look at people on the right, including Fox News and some people at Fox, including Bill O'Reilly. So I thought there was a few questions. I talked to Franken about all kinds of things, but there were a few questions about O'Reilly. So I thought it's really only fair to ask O'Reilly on, which I did. And he coincidentally had a book coming out as well. So it was an opportunity for him to promote his book. And I asked him many things. But I asked him a couple of challenging questions, such as, does he ever use the microphone to settle scores and mock people who've given him a bad review or who have declined to be on his show, that kind of thing, which I'd seen him do. And he basically gave me a long lecture about how I gave a nice interview to Al Franken, but I'd thrown every defamation in the book at O'Reilly. And then he told me to get out of the business, if I thought that was fair.
He must have made up with you or vice versa, because a year later you appeared on his show.
I appeared on his show, I think, because in my book, which was published in 2004, I wrote a fairly lengthy introductory essay about my approach to interviewing and some of the interviews I had done, including the O'Reilly interview. And so I suspect what happened is that one of his producers saw the book, saw O'Reilly was mentioned in it, and so the book was about O'Reilly in that sense. So O'Reilly had me on. And the interview with me was all about my interview with him and how unfair I was. Like the whole, the whole interview. And the funny thing was, this is a kind of funny story. I was, when I did his interview, I was on my book tour, and I was staying at a hotel in New York, and the hotel didn't have Fox News, and I wanted to see the interview, which I had just recorded. So I went to a sports bar around the corner that had, you know, like 20 different televisions, and each of them had like a, you know, a different sporting event on it, like baseball games and other like things on the sports channels. And I asked the bartender, like, would you mind if we tuned, like, one of these televisions to Fox News for just a few minutes? You can imagine what a weird request that is at a sports bar. So, you know, the bartender was very nice, and he turned one channel to Fox News. And when they were promoing that my interview was coming up, there was a big picture of me, and the caption said underneath, gross distortions. So I thought, like, anybody at that sports bar looking up and seeing that image with gross distortions underneath would think, like, who is that lady?
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. That lady is Terry Gross, and we will be back with more in a minute. This reminder that you can find out more about Terry's appearance at Paramount Theater in Charlottesville on September 26th. Just go to our website, virginiapublicradio.org. Stay with us. Virginia Conversations returns in a minute. Today, we're pleased to have with us Fresh Air host Terry Gross. She's appearing next month at the Paramount Theater in Charlottesville. And for the next 40 minutes, Terry Gross is with us. Terry, you have been doing a road show for a while, and you've been doing some interviews. First of all, let me ask you this. Do you do many interviews?
I don't do a lot. I've done a lot of interviews over the years, but I haven't been doing a lot lately. I have a really busy schedule. I usually work until I go to sleep weekday nights. I get up early and come to work early. And there's not a lot of time in my life. And the older I get, the more jealous I get of the time that I do have. So I've been trying not to do a lot of extracurricular stuff.
When you're getting ready for an interview, you put it all into the night before, right?
Well, you know, I have a lot of responsibilities on Fresh Air in addition to just doing interviews. There's a lot of hosting responsibilities. I'm a co-executive producer of the show. There's a lot of planning that I'm involved in. So there's a lot to do, and I don't have a lot of time during the day to prepare my interviews. So I use the time that I do have during the day, and then I do the rest of it at night.
I remember you're saying the paradox of my life is that while I'm preparing to be a sensitive interviewer, I'm a lousy friend.
Yes. No, I always say that on a weekday night, if a friend makes the mistake of calling me, I have to hang up on them so that I can continue doing my research so I can prepare to be a sensitive interviewer in the morning. So what makes me a sensitive interviewer, if I am, is what makes me a kind of insensitive friend. It's kind of sad.
We have a call from Elizabeth from Bland County. Good morning to you, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Oh, thank you for taking the call. I've been listening to Terry for probably 18 years, and I especially appreciate the political coverage. I originally was not at all a political person, but she began enlightening us to so many situations behind the scene when she has done interviews with Thomas Frank and one on John Hagee and the pro-Israel support, and Jane Mayers on the Koch brothers. I feel like Terry and Jane herself were some of the few to get us all in the know about these Koch brothers and their influence in politics. So I just wanted to thank her. And also, I wondered if she gets more requests for interviews, for people being on the show from the celebrities, from the people doing publicity for celebrities, and if that makes it more difficult to get political coverage in there.
Well, you know, we thank you for your compliments, first of all. And we get a lot of requests all the time from all people in all fields, including from celebrities, not from celebrities directly themselves, but, you know, from the publicists publicizing, you know, films and recordings and so on. And just because somebody's famous and they'd like to be on the show doesn't mean they're going to be on the show. You know, we have the balance that we're trying to keep of, you know, entertainment, arts, politics, culture, health, science, religion. And so our goal is to keep a balance of those subjects so that all of those subjects are well represented on the show. And it's often true on our show that, a new character actor is going to get on before a famous celebrity if the celebrity doesn't have a lot to say and the character actor does. Do you know, we evaluate people as interviewees as well as for their acting ability. So, and also for the quality of their work. Like, you could be very famous but not be very wonderful, or you could be very famous and actually be incredibly talented. And in that latter category, I'd put somebody like George Clooney. He's got it all. He's incredibly famous, big celebrity, but he's an incredibly talented actor and director. And so, you know, we've had him on. I hope we have him on again.
We talked a little bit about your being interviewed. What have you learned about being interviewed from being the interviewee?
Well, let me start with a story. One of the first times I was interviewed was by someone who seemed to want to reduce my life into cliches. So she said to me, "Oh, when you were in college, were you a flower child?" And to me, that's like such an irritating cliche, flower child. So I tried to explain to her something about my life then. And then she said, "What did you want to be when you grew up?" And I said, "Well, I wasn't sure if I should answer this honestly, because the honest answer was something most of my friends didn't even know. So I figured, in an attempt to be as honest with her as I'd like my interviewees to be with me, I'll tell her the truth." And I said, "When I was in high school, what I really wanted to be was a lyricist." And she said to me, No, tell me something interesting." Like, you know, some kids, they want to be a fireman. And I thought, like, whoa, if I have just, like, taken a risk by telling you something really important to me and you're correcting me, you're telling me that that's that only gets a D, she needs an A answer, and that's just like not interesting or good enough, then forget it. I'm not going to tell you anything. No, I wouldn't have walked out, but I certainly wasn't going to reveal myself because I figured I can't trust this person with the story of my life. And that's what I've taken away from being interviewed, that you give the story of your life only to somebody who you feel you can trust it with. And that it's my job to be worthy of that person's trust. And that's one of the reasons why I do my best to prepare as much as I can before an interview. Because if I don't really know and care about that person and their work, why would they trust me? Why would I even be taught? If I don't care and if I don't know about them, why would I even want to talk with them? Why would I be engaged?
People do get the sense that you're really listening. And you bring to your interviews a sense of wonder as well. You're always asking. You know, you said earlier, I wanted to connect the dots. Here's what I, you know, and that is there's a real trust in someone who's just, hey, can you explain to me this? And I wonder about that.
I'm an interviewer for a good reason. I have a lot of questions and not that many answers.
Is it easier to ask the questions than to answer them?
Oh, it depends. You know, I always figure whichever side of the mic I'm on, that's the hard side. Like if I'm asking the questions, I figure I'm the one with the hard side here. I was up really late preparing for this. You just had to walk in and answer the questions. But if I'm being interviewed, I always think, well, I have the hard part here because I have to actually answer the questions. So I'm just, you know, I just always think everything's hard. But, you know, getting back to your question about, you know, interviewing, like one of the reasons why I like to interview people say they do interviews because they want to find out what makes a person tick. I often think I do interviews because I want to find out what makes me tick. And by talking to other people and hearing the stories of their lives and hearing about the work that they do and why they do it and hearing about the questions they've wrestled with, for instance, with religion and about hearing why they are religious or hearing why they're not religious or hearing about the very personal, like, spiritual approach they've taken in their lives, you know, whatever, it helps me understand myself. And I hope it does that for listeners, too. I mean, I always think if we share the stories of our lives, we'll better understand each other and better understand ourselves.
You're an inspiration to people, even in ways you might not imagine. Abraham.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we've got a good one here. I don't know if you've heard this one before, but Abraham from Charlottesville says that you have been a big help to him. Let's let Abraham explain. Good morning to you.
Hi, Terry. It's an honor to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you for calling, and thank you.
I just wanted to say that I've grown up listening to your program, and your interviewing style, your sensitivity and perceptiveness have helped me organize my own thoughts, and especially when I'm going into a job interview and I'm preparing, looking over my resume, I imagine when practicing that interview ahead of time that you are my interviewer, and it's just been... Your program has just been a tremendous help in my own thoughts and things.
That is a really beautiful thing to say, and I really appreciate it. I'm kind of curious, what questions have I asked you on your job interviews?
What an interviewer would ask me, I suppose. You know, it's just your voice, not you personally, I suppose. But, you know, it's asking me, what do you want to do in your future? Why do you believe this? It's the kind of things you ask on your program. So I thank you for that.
I thank you for that. It's really I'm honored to hear you say that. Thank you. And I hope you have a good job, and if not, I wish to find one soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Abraham. We also have a call from Kendra. Good morning. You're out in Christiansburg.
Hello.
Hey there.
Hi, Ms. Gross. It is an absolute
You can call
honor
me Terry.
To speak with you. I'm sorry. You are actually my gateway to MBR, and I listen to you all the time. Pretty much talking to you is kind of, I feel like such a goober right now, but pretty much talking to you is kind of like, for me, meeting George Clooney, I guess, to other people. Because
that's really nice of you to say.
You've introduced me to so many topics that I would never have been interested in. You did a topic about mosquitoes. Who wants to hear an hour about mosquitoes? You made it so interesting for me, and I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. In that interview, we talked about mosquitoes as being these tiny little vampires.
Kendra, so, I know you're in Christiansburg, but you want to grab tickets to the Paramount so that you can see Terry live on the 26th in Charlottesville.
I would love to, but I just have a new son, so I can't leave him quite yet.
Oh, congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. And I just want to say that asking about the sexy man pose, that was a fantastic question because it's such a funny thing to see.
Oh, yeah, and he's great. And the actor that we're talking about, I'm just blanking out on his name. He's wonderful. He's from Philly, where I live. Silver
Bradley
Linings
Cooper.
Playbook. I'm sorry?
Isn't it Bradley Cooper?
Yes.
Bradley Cooper, yeah. I just blanked on his name. Yeah, he's really, he is a really talented actor.
He really is, but he's done the funny, sexy man pose, and you wouldn't expect him to be a great actor and then a great person from your interview.
And he was had a sense of humor about it, too.
He's an actually interesting person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kendra, thank you so much for calling in. And now we have a call from Andrew from Roanoke. Good morning, Andrew.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm here.
Mm-hmm. You're on the air.
Oh. Hello, is this Andrew? Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, my goodness. I am so sorry. I apologize. Ms. Gross, I have a question for you. I am from Roanoke, and I saw you when you came through Roanoke years ago, and there was a question I wanted to ask, but I was too shy to ask it in front of all the audience there. I was wondering if you ever find it necessary to deflate celebrity personalities with huge egos. And there's one example specifically that I had in mind. There was an interview that you did with Donovan years ago, and he had brought his guitar with him. Mm-hmm. And he played the song Hurdy Gurdy Man. Mm-hmm. And after he did that, you said, wow, that if anybody was to do a parody of you, that would be the song that I think that you would have that they would have chosen to play. And I was just wondering if you ever find it necessary to deflate people's egos on the air, bring them down to earth a little bit more.
It's funny, I remember the interview. I don't remember saying that. Did I say that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
But if I said that, it wouldn't have been to deflate him. But, you know, when people are very original and they start a new style, those are the people who are easiest to imitate because there's mm-hmm. something so unique about them. And so I didn't mean that as an insult or to deflate his ego. But if I said it, and again, I don't remember, it would have been to say, you know, like, you're so original, people do imitations of you, and that would be the song that they would likely choose.
Okay. Well, I thought it was great. I was glad you deflated his ego. So he seemed kind of conceited. So,
Andrew,
thank you very much, and I'm a major fan. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Terry, I don't know if you thought the same thing I did as Andrew called in. I thought the next name he was going to name was Gene Simmons, your infamous interview with Gene Simmons. And as I listened to that interview, I didn't realize until Gene Simmons pointed it out that women can get food by selling their bodies.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. Yeah. He's the only person I've ever interviewed him. He's the only person I've ever interviewed who said to me, if you want to welcome me with open arms, I'm afraid you'll also have to welcome me with open legs.
To which you said, that's an obnoxious thing to say.
Yeah, figured I could do one of two things. I could be like the kindergarten teacher and say, now, Mr. Simmons, if you continue to behave that way, this interview will have to end. Or I could pretend like nothing happened and say, well, in your second album, you recorded the hit song, you know. Or I could just say what I was thinking, which is like, wow, that is so obnoxious, which is what I did.
Have you ever found yourself saying that to a guest? Was that a first?
It might have been a first. My guests are rarely that obnoxious.
You know,
he's professionally that way. That's his thing. I mean,
that's generous of you to say.
Everyone I've ever met who's had contact with has a story to tell like that.
You know, it's funny. I don't know why the Gene Simmons discussion harkens this, but women in public radio and the role of women in public radio is pretty darn good. Why do you think it is that women became prominent in public radio long before they did in most other media outlets?
I have a theory of that, which I think is true, but I can't empirically back it up. When public radio was getting started, like when NPR was getting started in the early 70s, many of the public radio stations were on college campuses. including the one where I worked. And in the first half of the 1970s, the women's movement was very active. There were many women who were getting involved in the women's movement on college campuses, who felt like they were getting awakened to this sense of equality that they had never thought about before. And it was life-changing. And the student stations, which were largely student-run, were experiencing the same kind of changes. And so women had access to the microphone on student stations. They were often doing feminist shows like the one that I started working on when I started in radio. And those women, like me, for example, who got started on college stations in that early part of the feminist era, went on, you know, a lot of us went on to stay in public radio and, you know, continue to do other shows. And I think it had a really big impact. You know, one of the first program directors I had, I think maybe the first program director I had at WBFO was a woman. A lot of the people on the staff were women. You would not have found that in commercial radio. And part of the reason why, too, is commercial radio had all these different types of voices. You know, there was the voice of God kind of voice who was still doing the news. And there was like the late FM, laid-back DJ kind of voice who was into progressive rock. And, you know, there was the, you know, the middle-of-the-road, you know, record DJ. You'd be really hard-pressed to come up with the stereotype of the female voice because there weren't women on the air.
And I'll interject that you grew up in Brooklyn listening to Murray the K. Kaufman on rock and roll radio. That's very male-dominated radio back then.
Oh, it was totally. I never heard a woman on the radio till public radio ever. I really, outside of singing, you know, outside of like people on their records, I don't think I ever heard a female announcer or host until I was in college.
How have you seen public radio change since the early years when you started?
Well, I want to add one more thing about women. Yeah. I think another reason why women... Oh, is this a break? I can say it when we get back.
You want to do that? Well, yeah. Give the other reason, and then we'll go back to that other question. Go ahead. You've got about
okay. 20 minutes. Bill Siemering, who was the first vice president for programming at NPR, hired Susan Stamberg to be the first host, the first co-host of All Things Considered. So she was the first woman to host a daily national news program, and that was huge. And this was like 1970-something.
Mm-hmm. And we'll continue with this as well. We're going to take this short break and find out more about upcoming topics on Virginia Conversations on Facebook. We will be back in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Today we're talking with Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air. She's also appearing at the Paramount Theater in Charlottesville, September 26th. Terry, we were talking about women in public radio, and I wanted to be sure we get some more of that in.
Oh, another example of women rising to the top early on in public radio, Cokie Roberts became the congressional correspondent very early in the history of NPR. Nina Totenberg became the legal correspondent very early in the history of NPR. So you had Susan Stamberg hosting, you had Nina covering the Supreme Court and other legal issues, and Cokie covering Congress. So you had right at the start or close to the start three really strong, powerful women who remained strong and powerful in media.
And so how have you seen public radio in general change over the years? I mean, you're coming up on 30 years as host of this program in 2015. You'll be looking at – that's a long time in broadcasting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm kind of thrilled to have been allowed to do it for this long.
Yeah, because we all know that the average career length of a broadcaster is about the length of a fruit fly's life.
Wow. Really?
It's pretty short most of the time.
Yeah, well, I feel very, very lucky. So lucky that I forgot what your question was.
Oh, yeah. The changes in public radio.
Oh, the changes. Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, when I started in public radio, nobody knew what it was. It was really new. Like I said, there was a lot of college campuses. Our audience numbers when I started in Buffalo were hardly measurable because they were so small. So if you wanted a guest to be on your show, you'd have to describe what public radio is by saying, for instance, well, it's kind of like public television. There's no commercials. Because otherwise no one would know what it was. My parents didn't know what it was. When I started in public radio, they thought, you know, it's time to get serious about something. Like, we never heard of this. That didn't last for long, but they were very skeptical at the beginning. The technology has changed enormously. It used to be that All Things Considered, which was the only like live national show in the 70s when I started, came across phone lines. And it sounded like a bad phone line. There was a lot of noise, you know, a lot of like hiss and noise. It was a very compressed signal. So you could really tell the difference between an NPR show and a local show because of the sound quality. Tapes of certain syndicated shows were actually mailed from one station to another. I mean, there's no such thing as like, you know, a sound file, a WAV file. There was no satellite connections or ISDN fiber optic connections. It's made such a huge difference. It enabled us to have a national show because guests didn't have to come to the studio because the technology is so good. It sounds like we're in the same room even when we're not.
Talk about the golden days. We have a call from Patrick in Norfolk. Good morning to you, Patrick.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. We're fine. You have a tie to Terry.
I think it's a tie. And it also ties in with the conversation about women in public radio, specifically for me, minorities in public radio. Back in 92, 93 time frame, I worked for WHYY-TV in the Wilmington, Delaware office doing
oh.
News. And HYY, we had a big retreat. We wanted all the employees in Philly, and we started having conversations about where programming was going. And in one of the sessions, I chimed in because we were talking about participation and making participation available for all within public radio, and I started asking the questions: Why do we think that it does not appeal? Public radio doesn't appeal to minorities, specifically African Americans. And I started this conversation. At the end of the session, Terry, you actually came up to me, asked me. You said you appreciated my comments, and you started to talk to me a little bit about it. And you asked me what I wanted to do and things like that. And I actually said I had an interest in kind of longer form. Programming and formats, and maybe documentary video or longer form radio. And you invited me up to your studio when you were doing a show that next Monday. And the Monday was actually a holiday, so no one really was around. And it was one of the most exciting things that I had happened to me. Had an opportunity to come in, I sat in, I listened, I watched. I don't even remember who the guest was, but they called in. And every time I either hear you on the radio or someone brings you up, I think about that story and I relate that. And I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. It's good to hear from you. What are you doing now?
I'm currently a public affairs officer in the Navy. Once I left HYY, I ended up in New Orleans, and I was in TV news down there and did a little radio as well. And decided, hey, it's time to grow up and go. Let's go do something else. And I ended up becoming a public affairs officer in the Navy.
Well, that's great. It's good to talk with you. I appreciate your call. Thank you for reminding me of that story.
Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Patrick. We also have from Blacksburg, Keith. Keith, good morning to you.
Hi, this is Keith. I'm calling from Blacksburg, and I just. Mostly want to express my appreciation for Terry and all the wonderful hours I spent listening to her. I'm always, almost every time I listen, I'm always in awe about the preparation that's been made, the amount of effort that's obviously been put into getting ready for it, and then the questions that I didn't think of that were really interesting, and then also never letting somebody get by with giving a half-baked answer. And between Terry Gross and Diane Rehm, you pretty much both make my day on Radio IQ.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Keith, for that. I read that you read the books that authors bring. If your guest is an author, you'll read the books. On the other end of that spectrum, you have Larry King, who says, when I'm preparing for an interview, I'd rather not read the book because I'd rather approach the interview from the layman's perspective. What is your thought behind reading versus not reading?
Well, Larry King's approach worked for Larry King. It wouldn't work for me. My experience is that if you ask generic questions, you're likely to get generic answers. But if you know something about the person you're interviewing and you care about who they are and know some of the things they've already answered that are already out there, you can tune up your questions to get more specifically to maybe an answer they haven't given before, or something that's a little bit more revealing, or, you know, something that will get to what makes this person unique, what makes this writer different from other writers, what makes this actor different from other actors. And you have to know their work in order to be able to do that.
Is there anyone you won't interview? Is there anyone you either feel not worthy of interview, maybe too intimidated to interview, maybe, you know, is there anyone that has crossed your production table that you said, no?
Oh, we say no all the time. No, I'm serious. You know, the ratio of people we say no to compared to the people we say yes to, it's overwhelmingly no. We don't do that many interviews each week, and the producers' email boxes are always filled with, you know, agents and publicists and people requesting to be guests on the show. A lot of our guests don't come in as requests. We're going after them. Mm-hmm. You know, we create our own agenda. Who do we have on? What movies do we like? What issues are in the news that we want to talk about?
Here's a list. Go ahead.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, finish that point, because we have a listener who has a follow-up on that.
Right. Yeah. So it's not just a question of like, okay, we've gotten 10 requests today. Who are we going to say yes to? That's, you know, some of those people we probably will say yes to, but we're also initiating our own, you know, our own ideas and going after the people who haven't contacted us and so on. And just one more thing, getting back to being a woman in broadcasting, one of the things I had to learn to do was to say no. Maybe this is a generational thing, but I feel like when I was growing up, girls were taught to be liked. You wanted people to like you. You wanted to be gracious and to never offend anybody. And that's a lovely way to be in this world. But when you're a producer, you have to say no. And you have to say no firmly, and you have to say it a lot. And then when people come back at you and give you another reason why you should really have them on anyways, if you really think they're not right for your show, you have to still say no. It was very hard to learn to do that.
One of our listeners from Newport News, Susan, is very glad that you didn't say no to Bruce Springsteen. Good morning, Susan.
Oh, gosh.
How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you. I wanted to ask her about her interview with Bruce Springsteen and how that came to be. And I was really admiring it because you got him to open up about being a parent. And not many people see him that way, and I am a parent, and I loved what he said about if you're trying to be your kid's friend, then you're not doing it right. And I think about that a lot now that I have a tween.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love Bruce Springsteen. I think he's great. He's very hard to get in terms of, you know, booking him as a guest. But he was doing a show in Philadelphia at the Spectrum, which was one of the big stadiums that doesn't exist anymore. They tore it down a few years ago. And so we were... You know, we had been asking to get an interview with him, and this time he was going to be available for us. But we had to go, me and one of our producers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, had to go down to the Spectrum and meet him in one of the dressing rooms. And one of the things I loved about interviewing him was that he was not surrounded by this huge entourage when we met him. The publicist, who's a really lovely person, and he's worked with her for, I think, most of his career, she took us to meet him. He was alone in the room with me, our engineer, and my producer, and we just talked. And he just, like, walked into the room. There was no big celebrity thing going on. He just approached it like a person. And I so appreciated that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your call. Wow, that really gives a lot of insight. You probably have the whole gamut of insight into people, and I'm sure celebrities have surprised you with their persona.
Yeah, well, I love it when they don't have a persona, when they're just a person, you know, and there's no mask that's on, no costume that's on. And, you know, a lot of actors are like that. They're really, you know, they're really interesting and really wonderful to interview and very perceptive about people because, as Charles Laughton once said about his profession, acting, he said, people don't know what they're like, but I think I can show them. And that's what I love about great actors. They watch us, and then they reflect us back to ourselves. They know how we get defensive. They know what we do when we're sad. You know, and they can express so many, like, subtle shades of the human condition. And when an actor is capable of talking about how they do that, I especially love it.
We have another call from Emily from Charlottesville. Good morning, Emily.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say I've sort of grown up listening to your radio show. I remember my parents would, like, pick me up from preschool and everything, and I'd be listening to it. So it's sort of been, like, always there in my childhood and stuff. So I just sort of wanted to thank you for what you've been doing and everything.
Well, thank you. You know, it always makes me laugh to hear that because I always wonder when somebody grew up listening to the show because their parents listened to it, or they listened to it reluctantly in the carpool when a parent was driving them to or from school. I always wonder, like, does that mean you're going to hate the show for the rest of your life, or does that mean you stand a chance of liking it? Because I can see it going either way with people. Like, when I was growing up, I hated what my parents made me listen to on the radio. So I just never know, am I the lady that you were forced to listen to, or
and
is
she
it
can't
okay?
eat peas ever since.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Thank you so much, Emily. And we have a call from Elijah. Good morning to you, Elijah. You're a big Rolling Stones fan.
Yes.
Talk to us about that Keith Richards interview.
Well, I've listened to lots and lots of Terry's interviews over the years, and, like, his parting words with her were, "Nice try, honey." And
exactly.
I just wanted to get her take on that.
It's that, really,
like,
funny because
that just stuck with me, and I really wanted to hear what you made that out as.
Honestly, I still don't know what I make of it. We had a long conversation back in the offices after that was recorded, because when I was asking things about his life, some of which he didn't remember, and some of which and probably because he's used so many drugs over the years, and some of which he didn't really want to talk about. But on the whole, he was just a fascinating interviewee, and I thought the interview was pretty interesting. And when he said, "Nice try, honey," I wasn't sure whether that was a compliment, like, you did good, or was like, "Yeah, nice try, honey. You tried to get it out of me, but, you really didn't." And I think I'll never know which it was. I think it was probably the more cynical, "Nice try, honey. You tried, but you didn't quite succeed." But I don't know.
I don't either, and I just wondered. that one line has stuck with me from so many interviews. Because I never processed it. It's still a question mark.
Thank you so much, Elijah.
Yeah,
I think that is one of the beauties is we each walk away with nuggets, things that we remember. I remember your Wes Anderson interview. I just thought you really nailed a lot of things that he had not even himself considered. It occurred to me that there are things you were pondering about his work.
I love his movies so much.
Isn't he great?
Yeah, I usually see his movies like at least twice.
I love his movies too. And with our couple of minutes remaining, can you believe the hour's gone by so quickly?
No, it's really sped by.
I would like to hear a little bit more about The Road Show. You go to different cities and share with people anecdotes from Fresh Air, and you will be coming to Charlottesville on September 26th. What can audiences expect when they see you?
Well, it's a little bit like a Fresh Air blooper reel during parts of the show, because I play excerpts of interviews that went like really badly or something really embarrassing happened or there were terrible repercussions. And I talk about, you know, what happened behind the scenes for those interviews. And then I also talk about my approach to interviewing and, you know, a little bit about my life. And now I have a brand new video component, too. So whoever comes will not just get to see me and hear me. You'll get to see various videos and little animations having to do with the interviews and the show and so on. So it's a little more multimedia than it used to be.
And that is all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our guest, Fresh Air host Terry Gross. It's really been a pleasure.
May Lily, I want to thank you. It's really been fun. I genuinely enjoyed it. And thanks to the listeners who called too.
Terry is at Paramount Theater September the 26th in Charlottesville. And check out her book, too, All I Did Was Ask. We look forward to your coming to Virginia. And that is it for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.